All right, let me go to the Dudemaker hotline and say, you know what? Before I say hi, I'm going to ask how to pronounce his name because I've heard it three different ways, and I find the easiest way to go to the source, to settle a dispute like this, is to go to the source. So, George, will you tell me how to pronounce correctly, say, your last name?
Neumeier.
Neumeier. Okay. So let me introduce then, folks. From the American Spectator and Catholic Family News, Mr. George Neumeier. All right, George. You and I actually met. Maybe I should have asked you when we met.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, last year in Baltimore.
Yeah, I should have asked you last year in Baltimore when we were hanging out. Are you back from South America?
I am, yeah. I came back on the weekend. Yeah, I'm back. So I'm back on the East Coast.
Okay. I guess TAS sent you on assignment down there, right?
Well, actually, I did write my articles for The Spectator, but a Catholic philanthropist paid for my trip, actually. So, you know, they he wanted he and a group of people basically wanted a reporter to go down to Buenos Aires to do the kind of reporting that really hasn't been done by the mainstream media about Jorge Bergoglio. And so I was happy to do that because, you know, there's obviously a lot of material down there and a lot of the trip really confirmed for me what an absolutely horrible choice he was for Pope, because the Archdiocese of Buenos Aires is a joke. You know, the condition of Catholicism in Buenos Aires in particular and Argentina in general is really hopeless. It's a Catholic in name only country at this point.
And so it took a personal visit to actually go and witness what you witnessed, and then to go ask the questions that needed to be asked, which, folks, we've been reading at Catholic Family News and at TAS for like the last 10 days or so of George's encounters with people. Some of them may have appeared, if you weren't talking about the Holy Family or the Holy Father, quite humorous. If you are talking about the Holy Father, if you're a Catholic, quite embarrassing, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. One of the questions I wanted answered is, why has Pope Francis not visited his own country during his tenure as Pope, which is very, very strange. You know, he's been Pope for quite a long time. He's been to all the countries around Argentina on papal tours. Why hasn't he visited his own country? And the answer I got back when I asked this question to Argentinians and to people in Buenos Aires was basically, we don't like him. You know, he's not very popular in his own country. And the more serious Catholics dislike him the most, you know, because they know his dismal record in Buenos Aires, and they know that he's heterodox, you know, and they know that he's a political leftist. And that's another reason why he hasn't visited Argentina, is that the Pope dislikes the Macri government. You know, the Macri government, in his view, is too conservative, even though by our standards, it's really not conservative at all. But according to the hard left standards of the Pope, Macri is too conservative. And that's another reason why he doesn't want to visit Argentina. He's waiting for the leftists and the Peronistas to come back to power, which they very well might this fall. And if that happens, I'm told that next year, when the leftists are back in power and the Peronistas are back in power, he might actually visit Argentina next year.
I mean, what a turn of events that you have the Bishop of Rome, in the person of the Pope, who won't visit his own home country because there aren't enough welcoming socialists there.
Yeah, that's basically what it comes down to. I mean, I tried to be fair. I tried to talk to supporters of the Pope, and quite frankly, I had trouble finding them. You know, if you go into a gift shop in Buenos Aires, there will be a section for the Pope. You know, there'll be papal memorabilia and, you know, things related to Pope Francis, but it's really not that big a section of the gift store. Like, for example, in the 1980s, if you went into a gift store in Poland, there would be stuff related to Pope John Paul II all over the gift store. I mean, the gift store would basically be a Carol Wojtyla gift store.
That's right.
But down in Buenos Aires, the Pope Francis section of gift stores is very, I would call it like almost muted. It's very small and not very enthusiastic. And it's almost pro forma. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, he's an Argentine. I guess we'll have to put this out. You know, I guess we'll have to put out some papal-related items. But I didn't get the sense that there was any great enthusiasm for the Pope down in Buenos Aires or Argentina.
You know, you when you make the point about Cardinal Bishop and Cardinal Wojtyla, not only would you find if you went to Poland, but in almost every place, any gift shop that you went, say, for example, if you went to a Marian shrine anywhere, if you went to even if you went to somewhere in Chicago, Illinois, like the Our Lady of the Blessed Sacrament Chapel or something like that, which I've been to in Marytown, there were still. Now, you won't find very many Benedict gift shops. You will find St. John Paul II gift shops. Yeah. You can still find the keychains. You can still get papal coins. You can get all manner of things. And that's not a surprise because he was very popular. Benedict XVI, not so much. But Pope Francis, I mean, there was an obligatory, it seems, or maybe say, George, a perfunctory display of something that alludes to Francis, but not much else.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, it does seem perfunctory and obligatory, and you know, I collected some very damning and, to my mind, sort of funny quotes about the Argentine kind of ambivalence about Pope Francis. One guy, I asked one man, former prosecutor of some prominence in Argentina, and I won't give his name, but I said to him, why hasn't Pope Francis visited his own country? And he said, very bluntly, he said, he's more embarrassing to us than the Falklands War was.
You have to go all the way back to what is that, the 80s, the 1980s?
Yeah, when Margaret Thatcher put down that pathetic attempt by the Argentines to take over the Falkland Islands, reclaim the Falkland Islands, and it was a humiliating moment for Argentines, but apparently the disastrous pontificate of Jorge Bergoglio is even worse than that, according to this gentleman. And he had some other very pointed comments to make, which I guess I can't repeat because they involve foul language. Yeah. But basically, you know, he says that a lot of people they view Pope Francis as representing not the best qualities of Argentines, but their worst qualities. And so they don't really, you know, they're embarrassed to see him on the world stage.
George Neumeyer is from the American Spectator and has gone on assignment at the behest of some Catholic philanthropists and is also contributing to Catholic Family News and our friend Matt Gasper on the Dudemaker Hotline with us. George, let me ask you about TAS. Is the family that used to own the magazine, are they still in charge of it back in the 90s when Bob Terrell was the editor?
Bob is still the editor.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I know the family that you're referring to. I know that at one time Richard Mellon Scaife gave a lot of money to the Spectator, but that I don't believe the Scaife Foundation gives money to the Spectator anymore. But it's still going. It's an all digital publication now, and it's been around for over 50 years now, and it's still. It's as irreverent as ever.
Well, let me take you back to the heyday when I first started reading. If we could just go walk hand in hand down memory lane for just a moment. When I first started reading the American Spectator, Bill Clinton had just been elected. And Bob found R. Emmett Terrell. I've interviewed him a couple of times. You guys call me Bob, Mike. Stop with the R. Emmett. Bob Terrell found this this up-and-coming, very very thorough, we thought, and very energetic and enthusiastic and caustic young journalist. You know where I'm going with this, don't you? His name was David Brock. And
right.
David
and
Brock.
Now we have to call him David Crock.
David Crock. So David Brock. So Bob unleashes David Brock. And, well, the first series of articles that now this is before Clinton was president. Actually, I undershot by 2 years. I met David Brock at an event in Mordor in 1991 or so. This was shortly following the debacle that was the high-tech lynching of Clarence Thomas, which didn't work. And I still have the book, and I referred to it when Justice Kavanaugh was being confirmed. I went back to the book, and I told the audience, read the first three chapters of Brock's book. This is the game plan they're executed. They executed it against Clarence Thomas. They're using it now almost to the letter. It's like they took the book and went, okay, who do we have that can fill this role? But Brock detailed, David Brock detailed the story of what he called the real Anita Hill, right? But this, before the book was published, they were stories that were published in his success in, I guess, in a couple of congruent issues of the American Spectator magazine. And then after Bill Clinton was elected, you know, David Brock went undercover and went to work and did the exposés on Bill's affairs with Jennifer Flowers and some of the other, you know, what Betsy Wright used to call the bimbo eruptions, right? So yeah. TAS has always been one of those magazines that's not quite your grandpa's. It's not National Review, for heaven. No, we won't say that. It's always had that kind of irreverent streak to it. And I still read all these years. I've always gone back and stayed in touch with and have read The American Spectator. So, you know, when I met you in Baltimore last year, of course, I went, wait a minute, he writes for The Spectator. And maybe I hadn't been in a while. So I started going back and visiting the site. It's as irreverent as ever.
Yeah. And it actually, that Troopergate article, the article about Bill Clinton's use of state troopers down in Arkansas to procure women, that actually led to his impeachment. That was sort of the first stone that caused the avalanche, because it was in that piece, that Spectator piece, that Paula Jones was mentioned. And she used that as the justification for suing Bill Clinton for defamation, because in the piece, the state troopers basically say that Clinton claimed that it was Paula Jones who basically propositioned him. And Paula Jones said, no, I didn't proposition you. Your state troopers tried to procure me for you. And it was during that case that Clinton lied his head off, and that led to his impeachment. So the Spectator can claim, deserves a footnote in journalistic history for having caused the impeachment of Bill Clinton.
The only footnote that's not there that we wish would have been there is that the impeachment would have succeeded.
Right. Yeah. A Senate trial. Yeah. Unfortunately, the Senate didn't have the guts to ratify the impeachment, but it's a permanent stain on Bill Clinton's record. And with the Me Too movement and all that, Clinton has really been, you know, sidelined, and he's not as prominent and effective in politics as he would have been had that impeachment not occurred.
Now George is recently returned from his sojourn down into South America and into Argentina, looking into the history and into the biography of Jorge Bergoglio, who you know as Pope Francis. Here's a headline for the American Spectator, where Bergoglio buried his communist mentor. Now, who was his communist mentor, and what can you tell us about that?
Right. Jorge Bergoglio studied chemistry in high school. He got the equivalent of a high school degree in chemistry. And so at a fairly young age, maybe 18, 19, he went off and he worked at a laboratory in Buenos Aires. And it turned out that his boss at that laboratory was this Paraguayan communist woman named Esther Balestrino. And as her subordinate, I guess, Jorge Bergoglio would, you know, talk to her about various matters, including political matters. And he said that she turned into a kind of mentor to him and shaped his political education. And she was a full-blown communist. And so he says, it's the Pope who actually shared this information with a couple of journalists 6-7 years ago. And he said that Esther Balestrino introduced him to communist literature, communist periodicals, that she talked to him about the Rosenberg's trial. And he said that one of the really scary comments the Pope made was, I learned from her the value of communism, and I found in the social doctrine of the church what she found in Karl Marx. And the quote is not that explicit, but that's the upshot of the quote. And you can find that in that book by, I cite these comments in my book, The Political Pope. But at any rate, the bottom line is that he was the disciple of this communist, Paraguayan communist woman, Esther Balestrino. And then when she got into trouble, when she got on the wrong side of the state in the 1970s, as the story goes, this has never been confirmed, actually, and it's kind of in dispute. But according to the official story, she was killed by the state. She was thrown out of an airplane, and then her body washed ashore, and her remains were identified. And when they were identified, her family members asked Jorge Bergoglio, who is now the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, if she could be buried in a Catholic cemetery, even though she wasn't a practicing Catholic. And Jorge Bergoglio said, of course, yes, she can be.
Yes, of course.
A total violation, a bald violation of canon law. And so she's buried at this church in Buenos Aires called Santa Cruz Church. And I went out there to check it out, and it was quite illuminating because the entire church has now been basically turned into a shrine to communist radicals.
Oh, good Lord.
Not just her, but a bunch of other communists who were either persecuted or died. And she's given pride of place in the cemetery along with these other communist radicals. There's all this, there are communist polemics throughout the church. You know, if you walk into the parish, the pastor's office, the very first thing that greets you is a commie book by Leonardo Boff, the defrocked liberation theologian,
right,
who this pope has turned into a ghostwriter. And then, most appallingly, the Stations of the Cross inside the church have been changed to put Jesus Christ into a contemporary setting where he's being crucified by capitalists and soldiers, by militarists and capitalists, and so even the Stations of the Cross have been turned into communist polemics, and so that's what you'll find if you go to the church where the Pope's communist mentor is buried.
And I tell you, most people are going to struggle to believe this, and are going to say, "Really? Do you have any pictures?" Because
I do actually have pictures.
I know. I was gonna...
they can look up my article, and then they could even, I think Google even has some images. If you type in her name and Santa Cruz Church, her grave should come up. A picture of her grave should come up because it was actually, I think, a joint project by the state and the church, this creating this sort of shrine to communism at the church, which is really just that also exposes the church's complicity in allowing Argentina to be hijacked by secularists. You know, so basically you have the church allowing the state to come in and turn a church into a shrine to communists.
And
that's what's going on at that church.
And George, just for people who don't know, or maybe you don't know any Spanish at all, Santa Cruz means Holy Cross.
Right.
So add that to the outrage. Santa Cruz, the Church of Santa Cruz, means the Church of the Holy Cross, the Church of the wood that our Lord was nailed to. The Holy Cross, the Holy Crucifix, the symbol that even Hollywood gives some respect to when they put it in the hands of people that are rebuking vampires.
Right. But you wouldn't believe these. Yeah, I did take pictures of the Stations of the Cross, and it's ludicrous. You know, Christ is not being, taken by Roman soldiers. He's being taken by these, industrialists and capitalists and militarists. And it's clearly just it's an attempt to use Christ as an argument against, the evil Yankees, because we just saw yesterday the Pope say that, I'm very honored. It's a great compliment to be criticized by Americans. He's being sarcastic, obviously, because what he's really saying is that I hate the Yankees. I hate America. He really dislikes Americans. But it bears repeating, actually, that and the Pope needs to be, if a reporter yesterday had really been on the ball, they would have said to the Pope, you say you're being criticized by Americans, by North Americans. You're actually also being criticized by South Americans. Your own countrymen are no less critical of you than the Americans are. So what do you have to say to your own countrymen who say that, you know, you're a source of shame for them? Of course, nobody asked that question, but that would be an obvious rejoinder to his comment about, oh, you know, I'm only being criticized by Americans, by these greedy Americans, you know, these guys who are on the payroll of, you know, the Koch brothers or something. Right.
George, if you read beyond that that little headline there, if you saw it on Twitter and you went into, I think it was National Catholic Register or whoever had the story. I read the whole story because I'm always curious about these things to see if the quote's taken out of context, you know, because he gives these rambling press conferences at 35,000 feet, they called them, to see what context it was actually placed in. And I think that the context was correct, but the implication from the guy that wrote the story was just absolutely preposterous. Which is this little gaggle, you know, this 2% of what are called these traditional Catholics, right? This little gaggle, 2% of Roman Catholics in North America that have the audacity to go to things like Michael Matt's Catholic Identity Conference, attended by a whopping 357 people, that they somehow pose a threat to the vicar of Christ? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, did you notice that he and his defenders sort of dismissed these American critics as nobodies, you know?
Right.
So, but at the same time, if they're such nobodies, why was the Pope saying yesterday, "Oh, I was trying to get my hands on this book. You know, I haven't been able to get my hands on this book. I really want to see this book. I saw it reviewed in one of the Italian papers, and I really want to get so." Apparently he's keenly interested in this criticism that he says is coming from nobodies, you know. So apparently there's some, you know, he must be very worried about it if he's so desperate to get his hands on this book. But I'm sure the book, I haven't seen the book, and I'd be curious to see the book. But I'm sure it's a very, very superficial treatment, and I'm sure that it's probably as ill-informed as that Antonio Spadaro attack on Church Militant and those folks. I don't know if you remember that one where the Jesuit Antonio Spadaro, you know, he made it seem as if all the American criticism of the Pope was just coming from these Catholic Republicans, you know, at Church Militant and elsewhere. And it's just so ridiculous because if you go around and you actually talk to Catholics in his own country, they'll either shrug and say they don't care, that they're really not interested in this pontificate and that they don't care about Catholicism at all because it plays no role in their lives anymore, except maybe a kind of nominal and decorative role. Like you'll see cab drivers use rosaries as forms of decoration in their cabs, but that's about it. Or most people, if they're engaged at all in Catholicism, they'll say that this is, you know, we have a bad pope. You know, we have a corrupt pope. We have a pope who's simply not reaffirming the teachings of the church. And
now there's some stuff that's been written recently. George Neumeier of the American Spectator is on the Dude Maker hotline with us here. Can I quote you for just a minute? Because I laughed out loud when I read this. I want to quote from one of your articles, if you don't mind.
Sure.
During Pope Francis's visit to Bolivia in July 2015, he received from Evo Morales, Bolivia's proudly Marxist president, a sacrilegious crucifix of Jesus Christ carved atop a hammer and a sickle. Morales described the gift as a copy of a crucifix designed by a late priest, Father Luis Espinal, who belonged to the Jesuit order, no shock there, and had committed his life to melding Marxism with religion. And then you, in parenthetically, Pope Francis honored Espinal's memory upon his arrival in Bolivia. New mayor, had John Paul II been given such a grotesque cross, he might have broken it over his knee. I would hope he would have, since he and his family and his entire country were basically overrun, either captured or killed by the communists. I would with hammer and sickles, that he would have seen it. Maybe he wouldn't even have broken it over his knee, George. Maybe he would have taken it and pulled a Andrew Jackson and beaten the guy that gave it to him with it.
Right. I'm surprised I didn't see that hammer and sickle cross in a special case or display case at Santa Cruz Church alongside Esther Balestrina's grave. You know, because it really is. I mean, that captures that moment, just captures this pontificate perfectly. You know, he said after he got that cross, that grotesque cross, he said, "Oh, I understand the meaning of this. I understand. I appreciate it. I don't see it as an offense." And then Morales said after the Pope, they're going to even make it to their term or to the
So,
Joe Biden, did you see Joe Biden's eye yesterday?
Bloody red eye, right?
His eye filled with blood. So I'm wondering if he's even going to be able to make it to Election Day.
Or to Trump's re-election day, we should say. Well, George, where do you see on where do you come down from your with your knowledge of having covered this? Has he done some decades long permanent damage, or in has he actually pulled off some permanent infiltration, if you will, into the cardinality that's irreversible?
It's not irreversible, but it is highly damaging. And yeah, I mean, by the time he's done, he'll have selected probably 2/3 of the electors at the next conclave. And what I've heard from people is that he wants the next pope to be the awful Secretary of State, Cardinal Parolin, who's really just Pope Francis, but with a little bit more diplomatic polish. You know, he's more circumspect, I think, than Francis, but he shares Francis's left-wing politics and his heterodox theology. And so we have to prevent that from happening, I think. You know, we have to lobby the cardinals to oppose Parolin. And in fact, I've heard that this pope is prepared, actually, to resign the moment that Benedict dies. He doesn't want there to be two retired popes, so he's waiting for Benedict to die. But when Benedict dies, I've been told that Francis is going to resign probably 3, 4, 5 months later, and then he's going to try to hand the papacy off to Parolin.
Not something to look forward to. All right.
But, you know, Providence always plays a role in these things. And, you know, just like, you know, in secular affairs, when, you know, the unexpected happens, Donald Trump beats Hillary Clinton, the unexpected could happen at a conclave and somebody like Cardinal Seurat could win. And then that wouldn't eliminate the problem because the cancer of modernism is, you know, will continue to spread through the church. But a Sarah pontificate would be a form of chemotherapy, as it were, that could kill, you know, 20% of the cancer or so, and that's not nothing. So we have to, you know, play the long game here. We have to recognize that we are laying the foundation for future reformers of the church. It's going to take probably 100 years for the cancer of modernism to be cut out of the body of Christ, but we have to be the ones who are preparing, laying the foundation for that to happen by people, you know, decades from now.
Or we could just cut right to the chase, and the conclave could elect Pius the 13th in the form of Jude Law, right?
Yeah, I'll take Jude Law over Parolin.
We'll take an English actor over an actual cardinal. I want to thank you for the time. I've been meaning to get you on, and now that we've made some contact, hopefully we'll be able to have you on a little more often, because you're out there reporting on this stuff and writing for The Spectator and other publications almost every day. What are you currently working on? Just taking a little R&R to try and, you know, clear all the demons and communists and socialists that you had to meet in the life and times of Jorge Bergoglio? What are you doing?
Unfortunately, I can't afford to take any time off. And if I can plug something, this is shameless. But
sure.
I do have a journalism, George Neumeier's Journalism Fund. It's a GoFundMe account. You can find it out either at my Facebook or Twitter, George Neumeier's Journalism Fund. And I'm raising money so that I can keep, investigating the bad guys in the church. And, but this week I wrote about the despicable Theodore McCarrick and how he gave his first interview in a year to Slate magazine, the Slate online magazine.
Oh, good Lord.
And it's very telling that he would give that interview to Slate, because Slate is a liberal publication in the tank for the gay mafia. And the article, while critical of McCarrick, somewhat critical of McCarrick, it nevertheless serves his purpose of trying to be rehabilitated a little bit. Because in that course of the article, Slate actually lets him take shots at Vigano and say that Vigano is a representative of the far right. And so the McCarrick is basically engaged in a form of sort of anti-conservative special pleading and saying, oh, well, you don't believe Vigano and what he says about me because he's a far-right conservative, you know, and that works with Slate, that works in the liberal world where, you know, you can be absolved of your sins and crimes as long as you're not a right-winger, you know, and if you're being attacked by right-wingers, then you must be a good guy.
You must be a really good guy, right.
That's a subtext of McCarrick's outrageous remarks. So at any rate, I wrote a piece about that for The Spectator, which appears today, called The Theodore McCarrick Despicable to the End, and so that's my latest offering.
Well, folks, you can get the address to George's GoFundMe account in our chat room, crusadechannel.com/chat. George, I want to thank you for being with us. And of course, since you're always writing, you and I will always have something to talk about.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, I look forward to having you back. And you know what? I feel like that you should probably, if you haven't already done so, you should probably go find the most reverent priest that you know, and I will have him give you some sort of a minor exorcism for all the demons and all the evil that you were around and covering the life and times of Jorge Bergoglio.
Yeah, there needs to be a special post Buenos Aires trip prayer.
A post Buenos Aires blessing. I absolve you for having been in the press. Okay. All right, George, thank you very much, brother. We'll talk soon.